I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, on the verge of my own first plunge into the turmoil of China on the rise. I'm in conversation here with Evan Osnos of The New Yorker magazine. He's been 8 years in the new China, reenacting the role of the foreign correspondent on the grandest scale, covering an impossibly big story of politics and culture, police stories and natural disasters too, with bold strokes and a novelist's eye. Age of Ambition is Evan Osnos' title for a fine hardcover condensation of what he sees going on in China. It's something new in the world, he says, not least as a very long-running and high-functioning dictatorship. But another big pattern he began to see was a mirror of a boom era in American history, our first Gilded Age of expansion, building railroads and everything else in the late 19th century.
I'll tell you, the person who helped me understand the arc of China's experience over the course of the last 30 years was not somebody who wanted to tell me his story, frankly. And his name was Lin Zhengyi when his story began, and he was a young army lieutenant in Taiwan. You have to remember, in the late 1970s, being in Taiwan meant that you were the enemy of the mainland. They'd been at war for 30 years, and he was a young military officer who had been sent to the most sensitive place on the front lines of this fight between Taiwan and the mainland. You know, the mainland being the communist heartland, and Taiwan was, as it described itself, the outpost of freedom. It was this emerging free market system. And Lin Zhengyi had devoted himself to being a great Taiwanese patriot, and he got to this point just a mile away from the Chinese shore, this rocky coastline on this little island held by Taiwan. And he quite literally looked across the waters and realized over the course of a few months that he was there that the future for him as a Chinese person, fundamentally an ethnically Chinese person, was on the mainland. And he sensed, in a way I think that just the world was beginning to sense, that China was going to change in some powerful, almost mind-bending way. It was simply going to happen. China at this point in 1979 was poorer than North Korea. Your average person in China had an income that was one-third the level in sub-Saharan Africa. And yet it was a country that was, just in terms of sheer territory, as large, as varied as the United States, as rich in resources. It was a place that was just absolutely pulsating with possibility. And he looked across the water and realized, if I'm going to make anything of myself in this life, I need to be there. And he went. He swam to China, which was a completely preposterous thing to do at the time. Nobody was swimming to China. If anybody was swimming anywhere, they were swimming from China. They were escaping. And he left behind in Taiwan a wife and a child, and he had another child on the way. And he made it to China as a defector from the Taiwanese military. And he started over. He changed his name to Lin Yifu. And he became an economist, of all things. And he became a very prominent economist. In fact, he went on to become China's first chief economist of the World Bank. And years later, when I encountered him living in Beijing, I came to him and I said, how in God's name did you make this decision to leave everything behind and start over again? Why did you think this was even a plausible thing to do? And he said, every man has his aspiration. Every person is entitled to imagine what it is that they want out of life. And for him, he wanted China. And he went. I mean, it's just this, for me, it was this incredible sort of metaphor for the whole period that followed, which was this period in which people were setting off from one place or another with sometimes ludicrous imagined ideas of what they could become. Some of them achieved it, many of them did not, but it was a hell of a story watching them.
You write about so many stories of people discovering a kind of Emersonian self-reliance. I got to do it now on my own. A few of your favorites.
Well, it's worth pointing out that the notion of self-reliance in Chinese history philosophically was anathema. They're really, after all, in Chinese history, you look back and as an individual person, you were always embedded in these much larger forces. You were always seen as a member of a village or a family or a factory or a military unit, and ultimately of the great nation of the Chinese people. And even in Chinese art, for instance, if you would look back at classical Chinese images, you would see that they were these great landscapes with water rushing through the mountains, and there would be a tiny little figure of a person. And then you would look at the great classical images in Western art. Let's take the Mona Lisa, and it was a full-frame portrait of an individual. And in China, in fact, that the sublimation of the individual extended all the way into law. So, for instance, if you were accused of a crime, you would be not just punished yourself, but also your family and your neighbors, community leaders, because you were always understood to be part of these broader networks. And then all of a sudden, this economic change that began in the late 1970s, which so dominates the China that we see today, it gave people no choice but to look out for themselves and to rely only on themselves. And I set aside a newspaper headline a few years ago that said exactly that. It said, you must blaze your own path and fight. And so I started to see this in people's biographies, the stories that they would tell about their own path. That was the dominant fact of their experience over the last 30 years. And the person who comes to mind most of all is a young woman who was born at the foot of a mountain to a farming family. Her parents couldn't read or write. And her name was Gong Hainan, and she could reasonably expect to have the same contours of life that her parents had. But there was something in her chemistry that was a little bit different. She'd always been this way. From the time she was a little kid, she got this idea that she was going to sell popsicles to the neighbors, for instance. And her parents said, who are you going to sell popsicles to? There's only three neighbors and a mountain behind the house. But she
and
was,
no popsicles, probably.
And no, well, there were popsicles in town, and she realized if she bought them in town, she could mark them up and sell them around the village. And she did that. And she actually figured out which were the parents who would cave in to their kids. And she would made a map of the village in which she would have the most efficient route. And eventually, her parents, who regarded her, I should say, as something of an alien because they had none of this experience. She was growing up in this period in which China was at peace. China was beginning to be prosperous in a way it had never been before. And she realized, if I'm going to be anything, I got to go to the city. And that's what she did. She went off to Beijing, and she got an education. And then she went to Shanghai. She went to graduate school. And then she realized she had a very specific problem, which is she wanted to get married, but the only people she knew, or the only people her parents knew who might be able to introduce her to somebody, for instance, were people like them. They were farming families. And she said, I don't have anything in common with these farming families. You know, I now live in the city. I've got an education. I'm sophisticated in a way. And yet I can't meet anybody. And she tried these dating services, these early online dating services, and she sent in her money, and they gave her a list of people that she could go on dates with, and she started calling them and discovered very quickly that they were fake. They weren't real people. They had been composites that were put together, a photo and a name and an email address. And this offended her. And she called up the dating company, and she said, why did you do this? Why did you cheat me this way? And they said, well, it should serve you right for going after these high-quality men, that was the term they used. They said, look at yourself, you're not beautiful. That was the way she remembers their conversation. And she really was offended by it. And I think it's important to recognize that earlier generations didn't see themselves as having the right to be offended by very much. Life was hard and dangerous. And if you got through it, that was considered an achievement enough. But she realized, actually, I deserve a little better than that. And she decided to start a company, a dating company, really the Chinese equivalent of Match.com. That's when I met her. She'd just gotten out of graduate school and started this company. It turned out that there was a huge market for what it was that she was doing. And she ended up taking this company public on the NASDAQ, and she made $77 million. So I watched this transpire over the course of a few years, and she is by no means typical. She's profoundly atypical, and yet in the contours of her experience, we see some of these incredibly powerful forces that are driving people out of the village, driving them to start businesses, ultimately driving them to transform their own lives if they can.
There are people in your book who say that kind of social transformation and the financial explosion has sort of hit the wall. And lots of people asking, searching, hungering for more. Maybe the past, maybe spirit life, neo-Maoism, neo-Confucianism. Speak about some of those searches and what's driving it.
Well, what happened as people began to satisfy their most basic material needs, you know, they had shelter and food in adequate quantities, really almost for the first time in Chinese history, then they began to ask some bigger questions about what it meant to be Chinese in the year 2014. I mean, what are our relationships to each other as citizens? What are my obligations to you as a neighbor, for instance? What are my obligations to a stranger? If I see somebody that falls down in the street, should I help that person, or is that just going to expose my family to the risks? What happens if I'm a good Samaritan and I end up hurting somebody? What people discovered is that the institutions that they used to rely on no longer make that much sense to them anymore. Frankly, they don't trust the party anymore. They don't trust the newspapers anymore. They don't really even trust corporations anymore because they've discovered that the quality of ingredients, for instance, of baby formula has been adulterated in a way that has harmed some of society's most vulnerable people. And as they've discovered that, they've come to realize that they have what they call in Chinese a jingshan kongxu, which is a spiritual void. It's like a hole at the center of Chinese moral life, and they're trying to fill it. And each person is, in that sense, each person is trying to fill it with their own answer. And so as a result, I lived through this period in which people were going, firing in all kinds of different directions. For instance, they'd pursue one kind of religion, or they might then pivot and pursue another kind of religion. In fact, in our neighborhood in Beijing, where my wife and I lived, we happened to live right next door to the Confucius Temple, and then we were across the street from a Tibetan temple called the Lama Temple. And we would see people go from the Tibetan temple, and then they'd go to the Confucius Temple, and then on the way home, just to be safe, they'd stop at a Catholic church and maybe light a candle, on the principle that you never really know. But I mean, also on the principle that they were trying out this new sense of what it means to believe in something. Because for so long, of the last 30 years, people in China really haven't had the luxury of believing in anything except the pursuit of fortune, the pursuit of the most elemental thing in their life, which is financial security. And now that they've begun to achieve it, they're starting to look over the parapet and say, well, what else is there? And that's what leads them into these moral inquiries.
It fascinates us around here that Michael Sandel, Harvard philosopher, lecturer, interesting guy, has become something bigger than a rock star. I mean, there's a young woman in your book who says, he saved my soul. A giant celebrity in Asia. Explain this.
Yeah, it's been an interesting phenomenon. A few years ago, I began to hear about the success of Michael Sandel's lectures in China. You know, Michael Sandel, after all, political philosopher who talks about Immanuel Kant and John Locke and these ideas that we think of as very Western philosophical traditions, and he taught a hugely successful class at Harvard. I took it actually as an undergraduate when I was there. It's how I sort of learned an introduction to political philosophy. And then fast forward 15 years, and all of a sudden it had begun to circulate in China. And it had begun to circulate online first. People had subtitled it, just volunteers had done it. And then there was an official version that was beautifully produced. And so as a result, people who might not otherwise have the patience to watch a video, all of a sudden they tapped into it and said, wow, what's going on here? And they started watching it. And Michael Sandel began going to China. And I followed him for a while. I met up with him down in the southern city of Xiamen and watched one of these lectures. And I didn't really know what to expect. But by an hour before the thing was even going to begin, this auditorium, every seat in the place was jammed. The seats, the aisles were full of people. And there was such a crowd outside, massing outside of these glass doors, that the security guards who were standing inside were getting nervous. And they were calling, and the head of the university was calling down to them and saying, you got to manage this situation, keep it under control. And then this lecture begins. And the questions that Michael Sandel was asking them were, in a way, they were universal questions. He was asking them things like, is it okay to have a market for human organs? Let's say I have a kidney and you need a kidney and I'm willing to sell it and you're willing to buy it. What's wrong with that? Why should that be illegal? And let's remember, in China, there had never been free markets of any kind until fairly recently. And so this idea was just a completely radical notion. And students put up their hands and they said, well, if it's a fair trade and that's a reasonable transaction, then go to it. Why not? And then other people in the crowd would say no, and they literally would shout them down and say, no, that's what are we doing? What kind of society are we becoming if we allow that? And what was fascinating about it, and Michael Sandel, I think, finds himself in this slightly accidental position of being the vessel for this moral conversation that's going on in China today. And he has been a catalyst for making it happen. He's given people a vocabulary to talk about ethics and morals. What does it mean to live an honorable life? What does it mean to believe in things? What does it mean to follow a moral code? And they're not finding those answers in socialism. They're finding some of those answers in Confucianism, perhaps, or in Taoism, or in Buddhism. But he has introduced a way of talking about it that's accessible. And the response is, frankly, it's overwhelming. Afterwards, when he left the stage, these young people would come up to him and say, almost in tears in a few cases, and they would say, Professor Sandel, you've changed my life.
What does that tell you about China? I mean, two questions come to mind. One, where is Confucius? But also, what's the connection between Gorbachev going to the Pope, finally surrendering? We made a mistake in crushing spiritual life of that old Christian nation.
China, at the moment, I mean, the Chinese government is very worried about what this religious revival can mean for the country. And that's partly because they look at the Soviet experience. They're very aware of it. They talk about it openly. President of China today, Xi Jinping, talks about the fact that he will never, as he says, make the mistakes that Gorbachev made, which led to the decline and fall of the Soviet Union. He says this explicitly.
Which mistakes is he alluding?
Well, he means that when there were people inside the Soviet Union who stood up and said, there is pressure for reform, we must accommodate that pressure, that by taking those first steps, that it eventually began to unravel the whole system. Xi Jinping looks at that and he has said explicitly, there was nobody man enough, that's the term he uses, to resist that pressure. And as a result, all was lost. And so, you know, the Chinese government today sees itself in a bit of a race against the clock, because it at this stage, if it can survive another 8 years to 2022, it will surpass the Soviet Union as the world's longest running one-party state. And I think it sees that as both an objective and also something forbidding, because it recognizes that it's in uncharted territory. I mean, one of the things that interests me, Chris, about this odd government and economic system in China is that it is a high-functioning dictatorship. That's what it is, after all. And we don't really have much experience with that in human history. You know, we have very low-functioning dictatorships. You have Mobutu, and you have Hosni Mubarak, and you have all of these examples of places in which tyranny kept people ultimately in chains, or at least in poverty. And China's done something very different and very odd, which is that it has allowed people to get rich at the same time that it has not given them political freedom. And it's not altogether clear to us whether this is sustainable. Is this possible?
It's a huge question. Where would a guy like me go to get even remotely plausible answers? This collision between a despotic government and a booming economy.
For one thing, you have to go to Beijing. I mean, you simply have to go to Beijing. Chairman Mao used to say of Beijing, it's the crucible through which everybody is formed. And he was speaking from experience. You know, he came from the countryside as a librarian and in a kind of aspiring revolutionary. And he got to the capital where you had all of the misfits and the oddballs from every village in China converging on Beijing. And that was this political primordial soup from which the country emerged. And so you have to go there partly because for a long time, it's worth pointing out, you know, cities in China used to be the exception. They really were not the experience that most people who called themselves Chinese ever had, because the country was overwhelmingly rural and poor. And today, China is not that way. It's something else. It's passed for the first time in history, it's now majority urban. So more than 50% of the population lives in a city. So you have to go to the cities, and you have to kind of grapple with that and see what it looks like to see that 40% of the skyscrapers under construction today are in China. And
in all the world.
Yeah, 40% of the skyscrapers anywhere in the world are being built in China, the ones under construction. So you kind of have to see that. And you also want to feel what that energy feels like. And it's always interesting when you go to a Chinese city to ask people where they come from. Very few of them actually come from those cities. That reminds me in some odd ways of America, after all. I mean, if you'd come to America 100 years ago, or where would you have gone? You know, you would have gone to California, perhaps, to see the gold rush and to see what it meant to have, for instance, the Transcontinental Railroad finally link one side of the country to the other side. And you would have also, if you'd gone to California 100 or 120 years ago, you would have seen this these spectacular demonstrations of corruption. And you also would have seen people who had gone from nothing and had built themselves into America's first plutocrats. I got very interested. Living in China for 8 years made me fascinated by the story of America's kind of muscular period at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thread in your book that China is doing what this country did between the Civil War and 1900. What did you say? There were a score of millionaires at the end of the Civil War in this country. There were 40,000 by the time Teddy Roosevelt called them the malefactors of great wealth. So it's a kind of classic process, but so infinitely bigger.
Well, it is infinitely bigger. I mean, the dynamics are familiar to us as Americans. This idea that, after all, you know, at the end of the Civil War, the United States had to put itself back together in much the same way that China had to put itself back together after the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s and 70s. And you also had this enormous pent-up economic energy that had gone untapped. And, you know, the United States, over the course of two or three decades, surpassed Britain and France in the production of steel, for instance. And all of a sudden, you know, the country had built this railroad that all of a sudden allowed people to get places they could never have gone before. And China today is building more high-speed rail than the rest of the world combined. So some of that sense of ambition, that soaring kind of belief in possibility about what this country could become, whether we're talking about China or the United States, that feels familiar to us. It does feel a little bit, to be in China today feels a little bit like you dropped into a moment in American history that we can only read about. And I found after living there for all these years that some of the most helpful things I could read about China were actually in the work of Mark Twain and people like
exactly.
That. Yeah, because he would write about like what it felt like to go abroad for the first time and what it felt like to go to Europe as an American and how self-conscious that made you feel.
The president of China these days, Xi Jinping, speaks of the China dream or the Chinese dream. And people have told me nobody knows what it is. Can you explain it and what he's playing to?
I'm not sure that when he introduced this concept that he knew exactly what he meant. And he's developed this idea over the course of a couple of years. But the Chinese dream in the mind of Xi Jinping is what he describes as the great renewal of the Chinese nation. And that means not just economic prosperity, but it really means a return to a more glorious image of itself, the China that really is in the memory of the Chinese people. This is a country, after all, that was the dominant civilization for most of the last few thousand years. You know, this is a country that was printing books 400 years before Gutenberg. This is a country that, as recently as the 18th century, had one-third of the world's wealth within its borders. You know, there were places in China that were as cosmopolitan and developed in their own ways as Western European cities. And then it went into this period of 100 years of political turmoil and deprivation and invasion. And he is saying to people that the Chinese dream is to return to that period of greatness, to return to that sense of a more glorious China. And I think what's interesting about it is it's a sophisticated kind of message. It's understandable. People can get their minds around it. But when he came up with this idea and started talking about it, I went around Beijing and talked to people about what is the Chinese dream. I mean, I asked my neighbors, for instance, in the center of town where we lived, and I asked my next door neighbor, who was a widow named Jim Baozhu, and I said, "What's the Chinese dream?" And she said, "Well, my Chinese dream is to beat your landlord in the lawsuit that I filed." She's involved in some completely intricate lawsuit about property and rights. And then I asked somebody else, "What's your Chinese dream?" Or, "What's the Chinese dream?" And he said, "Well, my Chinese dream is to go to Singapore to visit my son." And so I got the sense that there may be a Chinese dream that the government has introduced, but it may turn out to be a much more complicated idea than even they recognized when they proposed it, because it seems that you've got a billion people who are now interpreting it in their own ways.
Evan Osler, you speak of so many wonderful individuals at all stations. Speak about Ai Weiwei, the artist who's a celebrity in this country as well as a very tricky kind of borderline dissident in China, but also, before we're done, the sweeper, who's a poet.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, Ai Weiwei is a guy who, in many ways, he could have had a very easy life. frankly. Ai Weiwei comes from a family of political and intellectual royalty in China. His father was Ai Qing, who's a very famous contemporary Chinese poet. He suffered terribly during the Cultural Revolution, like a lot of intellectuals did, but when eventually he was allowed back to Beijing from exile in the far western reaches of the country, he was treated as one of the great intellectual fathers of the People's Republic. Ai Weiwei, if he wanted to, could have grown up with all of that advantage in his life, and he did for a long time. You know, he eventually went and studied abroad in the United States, dropped out of school immediately after he got here, I should say. He never was much for school, and spent 10 years in New York City. As his brother told me, he said he basically went around town like a mudfish, burrowing into every bit of muck he could find. And he went and he hung out down in Tompkins Square Park, and he got into fights with police, and he went to galleries, and he got to be friends with Allen Ginsberg. And he just saw this kind of irascible quality to life in the New York art scene. And he went back to China as an artist, and he no longer fit in quite the way that he ever had before. And all of a sudden, he had all of these notions about what it meant to be an individual mind and to think in your own way and to buck tradition. And he pissed a lot of people off. I mean, he would say things to his fellow artists that they didn't want to hear. So he would say to them, for instance, you should be doing more to challenge the government. And they would say to him, well, it's easy for you to say. You've got this political background. You've got this family name that'll always protect you. And he got a little bit more ambitious in his political activism, and year by year he began to do more. And in 2008, when there was this terrible earthquake in Sichuan in which a lot of schools collapsed, and they collapsed because of corruption, they had been built poorly using substandard materials, and he got obsessed with this in a way that he never had been before. No political issue had ever galvanized him this way. And he said, I simply want to know the names of the children. That's all. I just want to know the names of the children. And he didn't see it as an overtly political question. But of course, to the government, it was a hugely political issue, because what he was asking for was to dignify the individual experiences of these children. And he became a phenomenon. I mean, this issue that he had introduced of demanding the names, it resonated with people who had nothing in common with him. You know, they weren't from the intellectual elite. These were many of the families out in Sichuan were ordinary people from the countryside who had just suffered as a result. And eventually, Ai Weiwei passed that always uncertain point in his activism that the government would no longer tolerate. And he was, I think as many people in America know, he was eventually detained. He was locked up in the summer of 2011 and was held in custody for 3 months on what they described as tax-related charges. He was eventually released, but he's no longer able to leave the country. He lives in a kind of legal purgatory. And I think it's worth saying that, you know, there are people in China who say, well, what's the point of paying attention to this guy? You know, you all in New York and Boston and elsewhere, you know about him, but people in China don't really know about him. Why do we care? You know, he's so out of the mainstream. And to that, I think there's two reasons why it's important to pay attention to a guy like Ai Weiwei. One is that he is a mirror, in a sense, for China's political instincts. You know, the degree to which the government can tolerate or not tolerate a guy like Ai Weiwei tells us something important about the government, about its state of mind. And then the other thing is that he's not quite as obscure as we might think he is. There was a study that was done not long ago looking at some of the things that are the most censored items on the Chinese internet. What are the terms and the cases that the censors are most sensitive to? And turns out that the arrest of Ai Weiwei was one of the most heavily censored subjects of the year that year, meaning that people were searching for it, they were posting comments about it, but the censors were acutely alert to it and they prevented that kind of discussion. Oddly enough, maybe the person who helped me understand what it felt like to be in China over the course of this period, these 10 years from the Chinese experience, was a guy who nobody's really ever heard of at all, who I met when he was sweeping the street in Beijing. And I was outside talking to a neighbor of mine, and this guy who was wearing an orange jumpsuit and a yellow straw hat and pushing a broom, he was part of this army of street sweepers in Beijing, that it's really, frankly, easy to just look right past them, and I certainly have for years. And he came up to us and started chatting, and my neighbor kind of, you know, brushed him aside and said, come back to us when you can speak real Beijing dialect, which is a classic sort of city guy telling a guy from the countryside to get lost. And I chatted with this street sweeper whose name was Qi Xiangfu, and he laughed and he said, you know, people look at me and they think I have no culture. that I have no education. And I mean, truth is, yeah, that's what I thought. And he said, what they don't know is that I'm a poet. And actually, if you go online, you'll find that I am the moderator of a forum dedicated to modern Chinese poetry. And I thought he was nuts. And I said, well, okay. And he wrote down his name for me, and I went home and punched it into the internet, and there he was. Not only online, I mean, he had an entire life online that was invisible to you from the outside. I mean, there he was. He was wearing a beautiful suit and a bow tie, and those were his poems. And he was a moderator. He was a thinker. I mean, he had become, in fact, he had earned the nickname of the Super King of Chinese Couplets. And he was a man who led a double life. He had a physical life, and he had an interior life. And it was that interior life was impossible before the internet. You know, he would go home at the end of the day and would tap into this world that was suddenly available to him. And it was humbling to be reminded of how easy it is to misread China when we look at it from the outside. And so for me, even after 8 years, I met him in the final months of my time there. It was a great reminder that we've just begun to understand this place.
Evan Ossus, we love this book. Wish me luck, and we'll talk about it when I'm back.
Godspeed, and I envy you. I wish I was going with you. It's a great, great place to be.
That was Evan Osnos of The New Yorker magazine. His book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Kunal Jasti recorded and edited this conversation with Evan Osnos. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. The conversation isn't over till listeners, that's you, add a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leighton. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.